Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Carmen.
And I'm Henrik. Today we're talking about a topic where most people immediately have a specific image in their minds.
Water supply in the Middle Ages. And I bet at least half of our listeners are thinking right now about filthy streets, people dumping chamber pots out of windows and, well, anything but clean drinking water.
That's exactly the point. This image of the dirty, stinking Middle Ages is so deeply embedded in our minds. But where does it actually come from? It's largely an invention of the 19th and 20th centuries. Novels, films, oversimplified history books, they've created a distorted picture.
We experience this at medieval fairs too. Visitors are often completely surprised when they see how nuanced things actually were back then. They basically expect filth and chaos, and then you show them authentic reconstructions of medieval water systems, and they're amazed.
And then there's the absolute classic among medieval myths.
People only drank beer because the water was so contaminated.
That's exactly the one I mean, and it persists stubbornly. But the reality was far more complex. Medical texts from the 12th and 13th centuries, like the Regimen Sanitatis Salernitanum from the famous school of Salerno, explicitly recommend water as a thirst quencher. You sometimes hear that rulers like Charlemagne had wells set up for travelers, but we actually lack historical evidence for that. What we do know, spring water was valued, not beer.
Beer and wine were supplements, for the taste, the calories, the shelf life, but not because water was generally undrinkable. That depended heavily on where you lived.
The regional differences were enormous. In cities,
it was often genuinely problematic. Rivers used as sewers, industrial use by dye works and mills. People more frequently resorted to beer or wine there. But for drinking water, there was also well water.
But in the countryside, with wells and springs, clean drinking water was completely normal. Monasteries even deliberately chose locations near streams. They knew exactly what they were doing.
And that's what's so fascinating. Medieval people weren't stupid. They developed solutions that still impress us today.
It's similar to... How should I put this? Like the misconception that people used to think the earth was flat. That's not true either. But the cliché is simply more appealing than the truth.
Although I think the truth is much more interesting here. I mean, Nuremberg had dozens of public wells and several water mains in the 15th century. That's not a primitive civilization. That's infrastructure.
Augsburg even made it to UNESCO World Heritage status with its historical water system. The Augsburg Water Management System. They supplied not just households with it, but entire industries.
Water towers, canals, sophisticated well systems, and all of that without electric pumps.
The Middle Ages is underestimated, massively underestimated. And that's exactly what today's episode is about. We want to show what was actually achieved. From monasteries that became true innovation centers to castle wells that reached over 150 meters deep.
Over 150 meters?
176 meters at Kyffhausen Imperial Castle, Germany's deepest medieval castle well. Without modern machinery. That's engineering excellence.
We'll get to that. But first, let's dispel the myth of the dirty Middle Ages. They had their problems, but they also had clever minds who found remarkably innovative solutions.
Let's take a look at where all this comes from. The Romans really set the standard with their aqueducts.
What most people don't know, the genius of aqueducts was that they worked completely without pumps. Pure gravity. The Romans simply let the water flow from higher to lower points.
And with a precision that still impresses today. We're talking about a gradient of about 20 to 50 centimeters per kilometer. At the Pont du Gard, it was only 24 centimeters. That had to be calculated exactly. Otherwise, the water backs up or flows too fast.
What tools did they even use to measure that?
They had two main instruments, the Groma for straight lines and angles, and the Chorobates for leveling. They surveyed distances of over 100 kilometers with those. The aqueduct of Constantinople was among the longest in antiquity. The one in Carthage, at about 130 kilometers, may have been even longer.
And then the materials. Opus caementicium, Roman concrete with volcanic ash. It was waterproof and has lasted centuries. When you look at the Pont du Gard, this bridge in southern France, 49 meters high, three-tiered.
275 meters long. The water channel at the top was about 1.80 meters high and 1.20 meters wide. That's impressive engineering.
And then the Roman Empire collapses. What happens to all this knowledge?
That's the fascinating point. Large infrastructure projects became rarer, that's true. But the knowledge didn't completely disappear. It was transformed, you could say.
Into smaller, more decentralized solutions.
In the Middle Ages, different types of wells then developed. On one hand, there's the
draw wells and flowing wells.
They work completely differently. Draw wells are essentially shaft wells. You dig a shaft down to the groundwater, line it with wooden planks or stone, and then bring up the water with a bucket and rope.
These were particularly common in the early Middle Ages. Easy to build, but the water just sits there. Not ideal for hygiene.
Flowing wells, on the other hand, are the more elegant solution. They have running water from pipes, often built around a central fountain column. The water essentially cleans itself through the constant flow.
Ah, that's why they became so popular in cities during the late Middle Ages. More hygienic.
Basel already had 40 public flowing wells by 1440. And monasteries like Maulbronn perfected the principle with, what do you call them again? Those washing basins in the cloister?
Lavatories. Those were for ritual washing before meals.
The fascinating thing is this continuity. The Romans had their castella, those distribution basins at the end of the aqueducts. The same principle appears later in medieval water towers.
Knowledge isn't lost, it adapts. They no longer had the resources for 100-kilometer-long pipelines, so they focused on local solutions. Deep wells, shorter conduits.
And the mechanics became quite sophisticated. With these deep castle wells, some over 100 meters, they needed systems to bring up the water. Tread wheels, for example, powered by humans.
That sounds like hard work.
It was, but it worked. These wells were vital during sieges. Without an independent water supply, a castle couldn't be held.
What made monasteries so special was their need for self-sufficiency. The Rule of Saint Benedict, chapter 66, explicitly prescribes this. Everything necessary must be available within the monastery walls. Water, mill, bakery.
And that forced the monks to think systematically. If you want to be self-sufficient, you need a functioning water system. A single well isn't enough.
That's why the Cistercians and Benedictines strategically founded their monasteries near streams and rivers. That wasn't romanticism. It was pure engineering logic.
Maulbronn is a prime example. They created an entire network there. About 20 lakes and ponds connected by ditches and canals. That shapes the landscape to this day.
Fish ponds for food, reservoirs for dry periods, mill channels for power generation, irrigation channels for agriculture. All interconnected.
And it works on the same principle as the Roman aqueducts. Pure gravity, no pumps. The monks preserved and developed the ancient knowledge.
The lavatorium at Maulbronn is particularly fascinating. It's located directly in the cloister, opposite the...
The monks' refectory, the dining hall.
The position was no coincidence. The monks could wash their hands immediately before meals. That was both hygienic and, well, part of the rules, I'd say. Part of monastic order.
A lavatorium was essentially a wash basin with running water. At Maulbronn, the fountain house has a circular floor plan and was fitted with Gothic tracery windows in the 14th century.
And what exactly was it used for?
Mainly hand washing before meals, but also for the regular tonsure, weekly or before major feast days, meaning cutting the monk's hairstyle. The monks actually found this quite bothersome, especially in winter. Here too, the water flowed constantly, just like the flowing wells we discussed earlier.
This also shows the spiritual dimension. Water had a dual meaning in monastic life: practical cleansing and ritual purity.
And the monks were clever enough to combine both.
They didn't just take, they also closed the loop. The mill received clean water from the deep lake, that's still its name today. And the same channel then carried wastewater from the kitchen and latrines downstream into the river system.
Weingarten Monastery had what was called the Silent Brook system. 10 channels, around 20 ponds, at its peak even up to 30, spread over about 25 square kilometers. That's an area some cities today could still learn from.
The monasteries were also pioneers because they had continuity. Secular rulers came and went, but the monks stayed in the same place for centuries. They could plan long term.
And they had access to knowledge. Libraries with ancient texts, contacts with other monasteries across Europe. Technology transfer, as we'd call it today.
What the Romans started, the monks perfected.
For smaller, decentralized systems, but no less thought through. Maulbronn is a UNESCO World Heritage Site today, partly because of this water management.
The most complete preserved monastery complex north of the Alps. And you can still trace the system today, the channels, the ponds, the connections.
What impresses me most about all this, they achieved all of it without computers, without modern surveying equipment, with experience, observation, and patience. With the growth of cities in the late Middle Ages, water supply became a real challenge. More people meant more demand, but also more sources of pollution.
The problem wasn't just the quantity. Craftsmen, dyers, tanners, butchers all lived in a city. They all produced wastewater. And when that gets into the drinking water, you've got a massive problem.
That's why cities like Nuremberg, Vienna and Strasbourg enacted strict regulations. Street cleaning, waste disposal, control of commercial operations. These weren't recommendations, they were binding rules with penalties.
So they already had something like environmental protection laws?
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And in many cities, a separation of drinking and utility water became established. Separate pipes, separate wells. Though elsewhere, things remained mixed.
This shows they understood the connection between cleanliness and health. even without microscopes and knowledge of pathogens.
But the most technically impressive were the deep wells. On castles where there was no running water
to tap into.
Königstein Fortress in Saxony, a good 150 meters. And the record holder? Kyffhausen Imperial Castle in Thuringia at 176 meters, the deepest castle well in the world.
176 meters. That's almost 60 stories down.
Yes, that's actually deeper than Cologne Cathedral is tall. Only going down. And that without electric drills, without excavators, without modern pumps.
They did it using what's called the sinking technique. You build a wooden casing, usually from oak, and gradually lower it while excavating the material from inside.
With shovels, picks, windlasses and buckets. Pure manual labor. At over 100 meters deep, you had to provide ventilation because otherwise the workers wouldn't get enough oxygen.
And it took years. With such extreme depths, we're talking about decades of construction time. It was a multi-generational project.
But it was vital for survival. A castle without an independent water supply was lost during a siege. The attacker could simply wait.
Do these wells still exist?
Many of them, yes. Kyffhausen Imperial Castle, for example, you can still visit the 176-meter well there today. Königstein Fortress, with its 152-meter well, is also open to visitors.
And then there's the water pipeline to Blankenheim Castle.
800 meters long, built around 1470. They channeled water from a spring to the castle. Complete with wooden bore pipes. Those are hollowed-out tree trunks that were fitted together.
These wooden pipes were usually hollowed-out tree trunks, oak or elm, because they don't rot as quickly in water. They were fitted together and connected with iron rings.
The Augsburg Water Management System, which we already mentioned, used an entire network of such conduits. Canals, water towers, fountains, all interconnected.
And they didn't just supply households with it.
Also trades and industry. Mills, breweries, smithies. The water was used multiple times before it left the city again.
Freiburg's Bächle work on a similar principle. Open channels that have flowed through the streets since the 12th century. From the very beginning, they served multiple purposes. Utility water, drinking water, watering livestock, and also firefighting.
Salzburg's Almkanal is even older. Over 900 years, and it still works. The canal system is over 12 kilometers long. They drove 3.5 of those directly through the Mönchsberg mountain.
That was a tremendous feat. With tools we would call primitive today. But the results speak for themselves. These systems have lasted for centuries.
It's hard to imagine how they planned all this without modern computing aids. No computers, no CAD, just practical geometry and experiential knowledge passed down through generations.
And the determination to get it right. Because water meant life. The Augsburg Water Management System received UNESCO World Heritage status in 2019, and rightly so. The system dates mainly from the 16th and 17th centuries, but it shows how medieval foundations were developed further. One of Europe's most impressive historical water management systems.
Three historic water towers, a canal system, magnificent Renaissance fountains, and the best part, you can still visit it today. The waterworks at the Red Gate is a museum.
They didn't just supply households there, but also the trades. Butchers, tanners, paper mills. Everyone needed water, and Augsburg organized that systematically.
And they monitored water quality while doing so. They knew that clean water meant health. They had well wardens who supervised this.
What's truly remarkable about all of this to me is this, how should I put it?
Sustainability?
Yes, exactly. They built systems that have lasted for centuries, not for quick profit, but for generations.
And with that, the prejudice of the dirty, primitive Middle Ages is surely debunked once and for all. From 176-meter-deep wells to kilometers-long canals to sophisticated urban water systems.
Medieval engineers solved problems we're still grappling with today. Water distribution, quality control, resource conservation. The fundamental principles are the same.
Only the tools have changed.
And that's perhaps the most important lesson. Good engineering stands the test of time, because it's based on understanding, not technology.
With that in mind, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this topic, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. There you will find not only products related to the Middle Ages, but also many more fascinating articles on historical topics in our blog.
And until next time, stay curious.
Bye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.